Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Wednesday, February 7, 2018. The time is 9:01 a.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman, Vice-Chairman Bishop, Senator Machicki, Senator Olson, and Senator Stevens. We should be joined shortly by Senator Von Imhoff, who is at another state meeting at this time. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none on today's agenda, we have the State Investment Officer from the Department of Revenue reviewing credit and the state's debt summary. I'd like to invite Devin Mitchell to the microphone. Welcome to Senate Finance. If you would, introduce yourself for the record.
Thanks. Devin Mitchell. I'm the debt manager for the state of Alaska, located in the Department of Revenue. So I do expect Mike Barnhill to be over here at some point as well, the deputy commissioner from the department. And if there are questions as we move through the presentation that warrant his participation, if it's okay with the committee, I'll invite him to the table at that point. But as you guys know, this has become an annual presentation that we've provided on the state and its outstanding debt and a discussion of the potential of the state to issue debt. So to begin with, and some of this will be covering ground that you're familiar with, of course, Senator Stevens, I think you're the only new member of the committee from last year, so welcome. but we have a debt affordability analysis that's required by statute. It was a law change in about 2007 that I think Representative Hawker was involved in based on a need for us to provide an annual, a formalized annual report on debt capacity to the legislative body as a means of showing strong management. And in the report that we generate, we discuss credit of the state, we discuss some of the outstanding debt and the ratios that we have associated with that debt. We discuss processes for issuing debt and when debt will be issued. We discuss but don't define a short-term debt capacity, and we do define a long-term debt capacity. And to be clear, it's a capacity that's based on the current policies of the State Bond Committee and expectation that the debt capacity that is defined or identified as a capacity at the current rating level that the state is at, and that it isn't contemplating potential changes to the state's fiscal structure, whether, as we all know, there's been a lot of discussion about changes that could occur within the state, and it doesn't anticipate or try to extrapolate on what capacity might be with various changes. These next two slides just show January of 17 debt affordability analysis to January of 18. And so the primary metric that we use for determining capacity is the percentage of unrestricted general fund revenue that our debt equates to. And so for general obligation bonds and direct state obligations, we have a 5% target, and for those obligations plus obligations like the school debt reimbursement program that we have a commitment to pay on a more lenient, I'll say, subject to appropriation basis, we have a target of 8%. And then we started last year including the percentage that the payment on behalf of the employers for the PERS-TERS liability represented as a percentage of unrestricted general fund revenue, just because it's such a striking percentage. And so you can see last year we were above our targets. The first column is supposed to be 5%. We're at 7.5% in 2017. That diminished to 3.75% by 2026, primarily because of declining outstanding bond balance and debt service, associated debt service. The second column, you can see we're well above the 8% target in 17 at 15.6, and that declines to 5.9. And then you have the PERS-TERS contribution that represented almost 15% of UGF revenue in FY17, and that actually increased through 2026 to 19.3%. And so that was last year, and this is this year. It's a little bit better, and the difference between 17 and 18 is primarily revenue. The revenue sources book increased their projection of revenue by about $400 million. And so that lowered our ratios. The outstanding debt has been static from last year to this year. Basically, the school debt reimbursement program is in a moratorium. We haven't had new issues of general obligation bonds. We have some authority but haven't issued in the last fiscal year. And so the diminishments are really a function of that increased revenue flow. And so you can see that we're just off our target now of 5% in the first column in the first couple of years and then diminished to 3% by 2027. We're above our target of 8% in the second column at 10.8, but we get underneath that by 2022, and then are well below by 2027, and that's really where our capacity lies, not is in the outer years of this 10-year forecast. The payment on behalf of the employers for PERS and TERS remains a substantial commitment, about 9% in 2018, fiscal year 2018, and that again grows through 2024 to 18% and then declines to 16% by 2027. And so, again, a fairly significant commitment of what we currently define unrestricted general fund revenue as.
Mr. Mitchell, I have a couple of questions on this slide. Can you comment on the governor's proposal to issue debt on the tax credit liability? It has a May, so there isn't a fixed number that would actually transfer. But how will that be reflected, or will it be affected if the legislature were to consider and pass financing of an undetermined amount of tax credits?
Madam Chair, so I have a couple of slides, the last couple of slides. We could jump forward to those and just discuss that.
Mr. Devin, we can wait. I understand that we probably already account for some of that and the transfer over, if that's the answer, so I can wait for that until you get to that slide.
And you're correct that there is some going to be some impact on capacity as a result of the issuance of debt to what I'll call refinance the credits. I don't think it's a one-for-one as if it were new debt because it's an existing liability that we have an expectation of paying over a defined time period already.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Also have a similar question, and then Senator Michicki has one also. The governor has, in his operating budget, short-funded the calculation for the payment on the PERS and TERS system, and I'm wondering how that, if it's not incorporated into the budget, how that will affect our percentages, because you're basing it on the statutory, as you explained earlier on slide 4, I believe it's based on the current statutory calculations that you're showing us, and the governor's budget does not fully fund that. And we haven't heard why yet. I haven't heard a personal explanation on why the governor's picked a lower number.
I through the chair, I don't know the answer to that, why a lower number would have been incorporated into the budget. The numbers that are included in this analysis are based on the actuarial analysis, so it's the payments that are otherwise due based on the percentages of payroll, which are predicted by the actuary based on the amortization of the unfunded liability in their
If I
work.
Could reframe the question, then what happens if the legislature does not appropriate the actuarial calculation?
Through the chair, that's viewed as when rating agencies look at credits, state credits, one of the categories of on their scorecards, they call them. So they have different things that they'll evaluate for every credit, and pension is one of them. And not funding the actuarially determined contribution rate is viewed negatively. In that analysis, so it would have some negative impact on our scorecard. other than that, it's there's a policy decision there as to whether or not that liability's amortization should be funded on the current schedule or an alternative one.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And for credit rating agencies that might be following this particular conversation, it's certainly my intent to advocate for what the actuaries are saying is required to be the payment. And if the governor has new numbers for our consideration, then I'll look forward to seeing those. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my questions were similar. I'll wait for the other slides. But nothing in this report is assuming that anything passed. You are going on actuals without, so we've been kind of struggling with that with the administration. Can you just clarify that these are all on actuals and that you've actually used the forecasted revenues from the revenue source book?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, yes, these are these percentages are based on the revenue sources book, and then the actuarial analysis associated with PERS and TERS.
Madam Chair, just a brief follow-up.
Senator Michicki, followed by Senator Bishop.
The Energy Information Administration put out their predictions, projections on the price of oil, and beginning 20 on out, where the state is estimating $20 lower per barrel almost across the board. Do you view that as a sort of range? I understand that you publish in accordance with the revenue sources book, but as you sit back, does your department sort of evaluate that range where the kind of rest of the folks that project energy prices are significantly higher on out years?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I don't work on the revenue sources book directly. That's a tax division product within the Department of Revenue. But generally, they do prepare bands within the sources book of price that then they choose a point within the band for their price predictor. And just an observation from where I sit, oil as a commodity has been inherently volatile in it. And as soon as you think it's stable, it becomes unstable. And as soon as you think it's unstable, it becomes stable. So it's a very difficult job that they have trying to predict the price.
Senator Bishop.
I wanted to dovetail on to the chair's comments. And if I don't get this right, please correct me on the record. But I, for one, will be supporting the actuary's recommendation for funding the pension plan. And the reason I say that, you don't need to look any further than the state of Illinois or General Electric to see what happens to your debt obligation if you don't fund your pension. And in light of what we've seen in the stock market in the last 3 days and the new widget that nobody knew about called volatility index funds and where that has taken the market, I would rather be safe than sorry.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. And again, for just full disclosure, my understanding is that we may see some new numbers from the administration, that they're working on those. We just haven't seen them yet, and without those numbers, I want to make sure that the credit rating agencies know that it's my intention at least to advocate for my community to make sure that we fund what the actuaries say is necessary for this pension debt. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Mr. Mitchell.
Yep. So on the next slide, I think the first bullet, I already said it was $400 million increase from 17 to 18. Maybe that was a Freudian slip that Senator Michicki's reference to oil prices related to. But there has been an increase, and that's the reason for the increase in capacity. The expectation of capacity at this point was a $300 to $400 million range, and that's up from a $50 to $100 million range last year, and so a fairly significant increase on a percentage basis, but still a fairly modest amount of capacity over a 10-year forecast period. One of the discussions that you'll see later in this document or in this presentation, and I think that has been a broader discussion over the last several years, is the concept of restricted revenues. And by restricted, there's been a category of revenue historically shown in the revenue sources book as restricted. It's restricted by custom, not by law or constitution. And some of the categories of that type of revenue include deposits into the CBRF. They're restricted in the sense they have to go into the CBRF, but then they're not restricted in the sense that they can be appropriated out of the fund with a vote of the legislature and concurrence of the governor. You have the earnings of the CBRF that are all in that similar category. And then most notably is the permanent fund and the earnings of the permanent fund, which are available for appropriation yet are categorized as restricted. And so we don't include any of those in our unrestricted general fund category of revenue, and therefore they're not included in a debt capacity analysis at this time. A shift in how revenue is categorized or creation of new revenue is going to increase our debt capacity, and something at this point along the line of $60 to $70 million for every $100 million of increased revenue generation over the forecast period. And so this, again, is a review of the state debt obligation process that in order to have state debt, we have to have authorization in law. In addition to that, general obligation bonds, which is a category of debt, our highest commitment debt, must also be approved by the voters of the state. All state debt must be structured by the state bond committee, which would include, of course, GO bonds, revenue bonds, or lease debt. The State Bond Committee is comprised of the Commissioners of Administration, Revenue, and Commerce, and so a small committee that's able to meet easily and is intended to be fairly high level within the administration. The other programs that the state has with the reimbursement programs, the school debt reimbursement program, or there was a one-time program, House Bill 528, that is a combination of some energy projects and Department of Transportation projects that the state reimburses local community debt service. Those commitments are also included in state debt. And then the retirement system, since the GASB rules changed, and with the evolution that's gone on within the reading analysis, we've started including that in our report, but probably not as completely as our other categories of debt, meaning that we haven't created a separate percentage of unrestricted general fund revenue that the annual contributions to the retirement system should be relative to, like we have for general obligation debt or the school debt reimbursement programs. So there's the potential that as our programs evolve, we would try to come up with a metric for that, and we just haven't done it at this point. This is right out of the debt book of the state, table 1.1, and so this runs through all of the categories of obligations that exist in Alaska through the state itself or its political subdivisions. And so there's basically 10 categories of debt, some of which are direct obligations of the state, and then they're layered in this table from highest priority to lowest priority as far as the commitment of the state. So general obligation bonds are the highest priority, $776.8 million outstanding as of June 30th, 2017. Then the AHFC, that's mortgage program, which is guaranteed by the state, and so it's a high priority, but the state never has had to pay. It's just a requirement under the federal law that it be a general obligation of the state. It's actually, those bonds are still rated AAA based on the underlying mortgage portfolio, and so they're not really getting credit support from the state at this time, but it's still an obligation if they were to fail. Then state-supported debt, like the certificates of participation that we have outstanding, and this is at this point only the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium residential housing facility in Anchorage, and then lease revenue bonds, which is primarily Goose Creek Correctional Facility in Mat-Su. Then state-supported debt, which state-supported municipal debt, which would include the school debt reimbursement program and the House Bill 528 program. The pension fund obligations, and that's where our numbers get a little larger, because we have the $6.6 billion for the total UAAL for the pension systems. State moral obligation debt, that's debt where there's a reserve fund, and there's an annual reporting requirement to the legislature and the governor on that reserve fund, which backstops the debt. If there were a deficiency, there would be a request for replenishment of that reserve fund. That reporting requirement and reserve fund establishment is required by statute established by the legislature and creates what's called a moral obligation commitment that the state would replenish that reserve if, in fact, there were a draw upon it. Then state revenue debt, which includes the sport fish revenue bonds and the airport system and the university, and those are paid by revenues collected within enterprise funds and not generally paid by revenues of the state. State agency debt is debt that is self-supporting and doesn't have a specific state backstop. And so you wouldn't expect that, for instance, if the tobacco settlement asset-backed bonds issued by the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation were to fail, that the state would be obligated to make a payment on their behalf. They're just reported here. And the same for state agency collateralized or insured debt. That's not something that you would expect there to be a draw on the general fund in the event of a failure.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
I wanted to let you know that Deputy Commissioner Barnhill did arrive some time ago, as well as Director Alper is in the audience. So if you need a lifeline or a backup or a wingman at the microphones, you're welcome to ask for someone to join you if you'd like.
A little bit ago.
At the beginning. The only other question I had was when we were looking at these numbers, this series of numbers that you started on slide 8 with on state debt, does that include unissued bonds, or is it just when we're saying it's principal outstanding, that is an agreement, a contract that we've signed into to pay interest, basically, and that we've sold those bonds?
Through the chair, the latter. So this is just outstanding debt. And it's also why I know the school debt reimbursement program, if you look at the public debt book, we have projections of the school debt reimbursement program, and it's just the debt outstanding as of June 30th of that year. And so they could then, for budgetary reasons, have a higher number or a lower number based on experience after June 30th. But yeah, all of this is historical.
Thank you. And then back again to just touch on the actuary payments to the unfunded pension liability. Those numbers that you're using were from the same date and time period, 6/30/17, and the assumptions then. And so the governor's team could have new assumptions that we might evaluate going forward.
They could, yes.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Von Imhoff. We did notify Alaska that you were on other state business. Thank you for joining us. And we're on slide 10 for those following at home. Senator Machicki.
Just back on that last slide. How do you feel about that relationship of revenue versus debt, and where do we stand in comparison to other states? Are you comfortable with that? I know we peaked a couple of years back, but how do you feel about that number? Would you say that Alaska is relatively heavily indebted, or is it a healthy proportion?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, there's different ways you can view the question. Certainly on a per capita basis, the state has sizable obligations relative to our population, but on a monetary basis or financial basis, we have obligations that are well within the realm of acceptable levels from that perspective. Certainly the unfunded liability is associated with retirement systems has been challenging, and it represents the largest liability that the state has by far. And when you compare us to our peers, we're somewhere in the middle. I mean, we don't have the best, we don't have the worst. On the bright side, we have been accounting for the other post-employment benefits, insurance, healthcare benefits that have accrued where some other entities had not. And so we have been more aware and had a more defined picture of where we are. We've also had the financial flexibility to transfer some monies, like in 2015, the one-time transfer into the trust, which have been beneficial to the funding of the trust. But it has to, I think that's, in my view, the it's kind of the elephant in the room as far as obligations of the state go, because there's a slide here that shows the general fund debt service payments by categories on page 11. And you can see that we've peaked in our payments for general obligation bonds, COPs, the lease commitments that we have, school debt reimbursement, and we have declining annual payment requirement into the future, something less than $225 million, which was the peak. Then you look at the bottom chart, and that's the that same debt with the payments that are predicted or projected for the PERS TERS payment on behalf of the employers, and it makes all our other debt look fairly insignificant. And it actually grows into the future based on the methodology that's been used for determining the payment amount of percentage of payroll rather than a level dollar payment methodology. So it's in my view, it's affordable, but and we have capacity otherwise within our structure, but it's definitely a liability that leadership needs to be aware of and plan for.
If I might, in addition to that, it extended the refinancing option per se, extended the debt further. So the 22% that is capped from municipalities, that burden is shared longer because of the path that we chose to go forward on a few years ago when we did make that $3 billion investment. So we continue to talk about that. We understand that it's a liability. For those watching at home, the payment could go up as high as around $700 million. It's starting to creep back up just over $500 million right now. That's huge, but the $3 billion cash infusion did drop those payments from $1 billion anticipated down into this neighborhood of $500 million. Please continue. Senator Bishop.
Just another comment on that. As we talk about the 22.5% going forward, I think there might be a discussion that's worthy having someday on the termination study that could drop payments.
Certainly the municipalities are interested in termination studies to reduce their liability to the trust, but the state would still be on the hook for all the remaining assets or the employees that were still in the system. So municipalities are absolutely contacting us asking that we look at termination studies. Mr. Mitchell, please continue.
Thank you. Just an observation. It's a tough balancing act because there are choices to be made there, and any choice that the state makes as far as how much it pays, that doesn't make the requirement for payment go away. It means somebody else is going to pay, and in that instance, the municipalities. So it's just a matter of how we pay, not if we pay.
Senator Bishop.
So I just go back to what I said a little bit ago. The good news is it's not $231 billion, and it's not $31 billion, like General Electric in the state of Illinois.
Senator Bishop, the pension liability in America is huge. That is an absolute fact, and we have done at least a step in the right direction with a cash infusion. We have tried to protect municipalities with a 22% cap, so municipalities have a payment due to the unfunded liability that is steady for them but unsteady for us. And so as we see those numbers creep up, the state increasingly takes on the role of paying for people that are working in municipalities and their benefits versus exclusively state responsibilities. I would say, I don't know if this number is true, Mr. Mitchell, still, but the last time you were here, about 60% of the PERS liability is the states and 40% is the municipalities and other organizations that are in our state that are using the PERS system also. Is that still accurate?
Through the chair, generally, yes.
Generally, yeah. Thank you. Senator Michiki.
So I'm sorry, it is good. I'll wait till you get to the next slide. My questions are on the next slide.
And so this slide I actually put together just based on a request from Madam Chair's office for some historical data, and it was interesting just because it does show how back in 2000 we'd been through the decade of the 1990s, and there had been a lot of revenue suppression, you know, the flat $2.3 billion budgets of the 1990s, and so there had been a moratorium back then on the school debt reimbursement program as well. We'd actually paid off all of our general obligation debt, hadn't had a general obligation bond issue since 1987 or something. We had some COP debt, and we had some residual school debt reimbursement program debt. And then you can see how we kind of started ramping up in the early 2000 decade and hit a peak in 2016 at just under $2 billion in total principal outstanding. And you can see where the growth occurred primarily in state general obligation bonds, and those were for transportation projects and education projects. And then, in addition, in the school debt reimbursement program. And what's hopeful about this slide is the declines that occur every year after today in outstanding balance. And so what that shows is that we have a fairly mature program that we've layered debt on a stair-step basis, and then debt, as of this point, layers off. And so if the state did need to issue additional debt there, as years go by, if all things remain equal from a revenue perspective, capacity is automatically created.
I just would like to compliment the Senate Finance Committee and the House Finance Committee for actually taking on that task several years ago to place a moratorium on school debt reimbursement. I know that's a struggle for local municipalities, but it was the only way we could get control of our mounting debt that other folks were taking. I know that we need to still take up that issue for communities that need help, but it truly is helping us right now dig our way out a little bit, and I believe we have two more years of the moratorium on it, and hopefully we'll have some rebound in revenue going forward, so that when that opens up, that there's a little bit more control on the debt placed on the burden placed on the state by local communities' needs. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
And we already talked about this slide, but did you have some questions?
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell. I appreciate you being here. So one of the questions, or one of the, I guess, thoughts and comments that I have is, I see you made a comment that we are very mature, we have lots of layers. I like the down slope to the right here. The biggest concern in the previous slides, you can see how the PERS and TERS payments are gonna go up quite a bit in the future. That's a huge concern. Of course, when the school reimbursement more to, or that bill when that expires. I don't know how that's going to affect this graph. Okay.
I guess through the chair, if you would expect that after a period of not allowing participation, if there were an open authorization, then there would be some level of debt issued that would be related to that pent-up demand. So you'd expect some increase in principal outstanding. What the legislature did at certain periods of time in the past is they would have limited authorizations for participation in the program. So they would craftily put together these bills that said with, and Senator Hoffman probably has a good recollection, but if you have a population, a student body population between 1,000 and 1,050, you're eligible for this much participation, and there's only one school district that has that student enrollment.
I got it. Okay, so and that's embedded, those estimates are potentially embedded in this blue portion of the slide?
This is just outstanding debt.
This is just outstanding debt. So it could change differently depending on how we behave in the future. All right. Just the other comment is I've been speaking to a couple groups here about a spending cap and spending limits, and I can't help but muse that had we had a spending cap in place in 2006, 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, when we grew the budget quite a bit, I think our office is doing about, we've estimated about $18 billion was left on the table that could have been used to pay some of this debt down had we not had as large of a budget, because we would have not taken as big of a draw from the CBR. And we would have put more money into the CBR in those high years. So that would have been a much flatter curve had we had a spending cap in place. Thank you, sir.
Senator Michiki.
Yeah, just before we move to the next slide, I think it's important for folks to realize that school debt reimbursement, the slide that just disappeared, is approximately half of our debt on this slide. I mean, that's just something we're going to have to keep a focus on going forward. There's no question about it. But actually, the next slide was where my questions were going to be. I kind of wish they were in the same scale, because our minds look at charts like this and we automatically try to place them on the same scale, and they're not. Mm-hmm. Do you have creative thoughts about managing our PERS TERS debt? Are we doing the best we can? Do you have other thoughts on sort of flattening or a better management system for that outstanding liability going forward?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki. It's a very complex and difficult issue for folks to consider, and I don't necessarily have solutions. I think that we know there are alternatives to this payment methodology, from paying the entire assumed liability off today to not paying anything more into the trust and assume we're going to pay as funding is needed in those future years. Those are kind of the bookends, and everything in between is the range of possibility. What is the best thing from a fiscal or a prudent perspective from where I sit? And I would lean more towards the paying it today than to shifting to a pay as you go formula, just because of the benefits of having set money aside in the trust so that you know this funding is going to be available. So the situation that Senator von Imhoff discussed, where you have then largesse because of high revenue years, doesn't result in excessive spending on non-core needs or non-existing liability need. I don't know if that helps, but I don't know that I can give you specificity on that question.
Senator von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to add, it does make more sense to spend now versus spend later, simply because if we've seen the stock market crash and rebound in the last few days, it was largely part due to fears of inflation. And as the power of the dollar decreases potentially in the future, the dollar spent now will have more impact now than they will in the future. So I do appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. In addition, on the stock market, some people try to pull and actually realize their gains at a particular moment. And so I'm sure we have a few people that are happy that may have taken their investments out of the market to escape a potential downturn draw. On slide 10, Mr. Mitchell, I just want to make sure that Alaskans understand that this is not how the state behaves on the largest component of our debt. It is how municipalities behave and their expectation of the state matching funds that incur debt for us. So while they're incurring debt, when they talk to the people that benefit in their communities, they are indebting the state without really any check and balance in place for the state's ability to pay that debt. And so that is the program. Under the moratorium, we did reduce the percentages. So the 70% and 60 will no longer be available to those municipalities. So we hope to have a better conversation happen at a local level. When indebting themselves, they would be indebting themselves at a greater percent and indebting the state at a less. So now I believe it's 40-60 and 50-50 versus before it was 60-40 and 70-30. So we have taken a measure in the bill that this body advanced and that the other body supported to try to mitigate some of that risk on our own finances. But it is the cities who have bonding authority that are affecting the growth of that particular segment of this debt.
And through the chair, I guess as long as you're talking about it, if you were going to renew the program, it might be beneficial to consider revamping it in the sense that if the state's going to be supporting debt, why not have the state issue debt and have the state provide grants to local districts that they can match however they choose? I hear districts from time to time say that they have a surplus or their borough has a surplus and they would just pay cash for their portion. Under the current program, they can't. They have to borrow money for at least 10 years to participate in the program, and not doing so would be foolish. If instead you said, well, the state will provide you a grant equal to some percentage of your project, which could be funded from debt, so it still provides budgetary predictability and stabilization, and you provide your local share however you see fit, then the state retains control of its debt. The municipality has more flexibility. The municipality no longer has the worry that the state won't appropriate for this program, which they have on the table right now. The state could say, hey, sorry, we're not going to appropriate for that any longer. And they would have to pay the full weight of the outstanding bonds. And so there could be, anyway, it's just a discussion for a future time.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is another area I think that needs to be addressed by the state of Alaska, and that is the ability of municipalities once they initiate the debt, particularly those at 70-30, and then they refinance. We pay the 70%, but when they refinance, isn't it true that they take all of those savings on the refinance?
Through the chair, Senator.
At a lower interest rate?
They should be pro rata applied, and so whenever there's a refinancing. So I also work at the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank.
So I wonder if you could double check on that, if that is actually the case that's happening, because we should also be benefiting by that, because they're the ones that issue it, and we just pay the debt. So I don't see how, if they're in control of issuing the debt when they refinance, I don't believe that they're sharing in that savings with the state. So if you could check on that, that could be a large sum of money that the state is potentially missing out on.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. In addition to that, as we look at this particular portion of our debt, my understanding is that if they have a higher interest rate in some municipalities on their debt, it's up to them whether they want to refinance it or not at all. And so we might see at a state level an opportunity to refinance for a lower interest rate, but there's nothing in state statute that requires the municipalities who are carrying the debt to take advantage of that lower interest rate. And for good reason, in some cases, that the total cost of doing that may not be something that is desirable for whatever reason to the municipality itself. I would like to go back to Senator Michicki's thought about what we could do in a structured way to help reduce our debt. And I know, I'll just put it out here, the administration did propose using pension obligation bonds, which was a tool that is existing in Alaska state statute. And the administration, I think it was $2.4 billion or right around that number. And the legislature was very uncomfortable with that, with the volatility in the stock market. I'm guessing if we looked at that right now, we would have seen a net gain based on the run-up of the market. But that doesn't mean over the long haul that we still wouldn't have seen what other cities had suffered, and that is an eventual downfall of the market as it recorrected. I'm not sure we're going to have time to complete our presentation today. Mr. Mitchell, are you available to come back on Monday? Do you know? Or could you contact my staff? And
I believe so.
Thank you. If we could, we need to, we have about five more minutes if you want to, if there's a stopping point.
So we could, I guess, talk about this last slide briefly. And so I had a question about short-term debt, and we don't really discuss it a lot within the debt affordability analysis. And there's really two types of short-term debt. Short-term debt that actually is short-term, meaning it's fully repaid in a short period of time inside of 2 years, or short-term debt that's issued in anticipation of long-term debt. And so one, the short-term debt that's in anticipation of revenue within the next 2 years really isn't going to impact debt capacity because it's going to be issued in more of an administrative or operational role rather than something that you expect to repay over a number of years with future year revenue like a bond bond anticipation note would be. The one thing that I could see, we haven't issued revenue anticipation notes since the 1960s. They're automatically authorized in statute. To the extent there's a revenue deficiency intra-fiscal year, the administration can borrow money for purposes of providing for appropriations based on an expectation of revenue later in the fiscal year. And that debt can be issued for a period of up to 2 years. Well, it would really be something inside of that because it has to be repaid by the end of the next fiscal year. And revenue anticipation notes, to the extent you do have a true cash deficiency intra-fiscal year, can be issued tax-exempt. The municipality of Anchorage has a tax anticipation note program that they issue bonds, short-term notes every year, that they keep money invested in taxable securities. They borrow on a tax-exempt basis, and they have a spread between those two on that short-term basis that winds up monetarily being beneficial to the municipality. And so to the extent we can use revenue anticipation notes, it would be beneficial to us financially, but you have to have a bona fide deficiency, and claiming we have a deficiency based on unrestricted general funds current definition, I don't think would pass tax muster because we have other revenue that we have available but aren't. Even though we call it restricted by custom, it still is available from a tax perspective. And so if we have a shift in how revenues are identified and generated within our state's structure, there could be a potential of revenue anticipation notes being used in the future. And I guess what I'm referring to is if the permanent fund starts getting used to help pay for state government as part of that core, what do we have right now, 4.3, 4.4 billion in spending that we're trying to provide for. If it's a known anticipated part of that spending and there and that spending is based on dividends and interest of the permanent fund, then there could be a cash deficiency intra-fiscal year that you wind up seeing revenue anticipation notes in the future.
Senator Von Imhoff.
I'll make it quick. The second to last bullet, earnings of the permanent fund and other available fund earnings will be need to be included. Is that federal law or that's federal law?
Sure, okay. Yes. And that's for purposes of tax exemption. You could issue taxable securities that you wouldn't need to have that hurdle met.
What's the difference in?
In rate?
Yeah.
Currently, it's fairly modest, but if it were 20 basis points on a short-term play, it's kind of the basis of doing the transaction. And many, if you're doing $100 million and you're earning 20 basis points by having taxable versus tax-exempt, and then if you're doing taxable versus taxable, then you have to take credit risk in order to get yield at the same maturity levels, you know, maturity timeframes.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
And that would probably be a good place to break since this next segment is.
Thank you. I think that that's an excellent breaking point. So on Monday, we'll take up what's labeled item 3, state debt rating overview, and then we'll have Senator McChickie's follow-up questions on the tax credits and the financing, that conversation a little bit more. Is there any last questions for Mr. Mitchell? Thank you for joining us today in Senate Finance. On tomorrow's agenda at 9 a.m., we'll have a presentation on the health care authority studies from the contractor with the Department of Administration. With that, we're adjourned.